What you're about to hear is a lecture by Mike Loria. You're going to be hearing more from Mike. I'm bringing him on the podcast to do an interview. Mike right now is a paramedic with the Dartmouth Advanced Response Team. He is starting medical school in the fall. He was Air Force Pararescue. You probably don't know what that means. If you do, then you know why I want to bring him on the podcast. And if you don't, you will know shortly. For now, know he has a special interest in cognitive psychology, the response to stress, and how we could perform better when under pressure. And that's what you're going to hear about right now.
I have nothing to disclose, no conflicts of interest. I haven't figured out how to make money off other companies yet, but I'm working on that. I do have a disclaimer, though, and that is I don't consider this lecture is about cognition and decision making, but I don't consider myself by any means to be an expert in clinical decision making. This presentation is really an amalgamation of my experiences and opinions in the military and training at other facilities and institutions. It's a work in progress. It's always changing. So by all means, if you have any feedback, thoughts, let me know at the end. I'm always looking at changes around. So key concept. So like 2 hours from now, 2 days from now, 2 weeks from now, this is the stuff that I want you guys to walk away from here with. First, how we make really complex decisions, especially those that are made under stress. Also, Boyd's Loop, something I'm going to talk about, is a model we use in the military to talk about how people make decisions. And finally, how I think we can improve our decision making. I'm going to give you five things I think we can do on a regular basis to improve the way that we make decisions. So first of all, so cognitive aptitude and special operations, it's not something we really talk about, but it's really, really important. So you don't see it on like the National Geographic or Discovery Channel specials on Green Berets and Navy SEALs, but it's really, really important. In fact, if you ask people about what do you think are the important values to an operator, what are value qualities in someone in special operations, I mean, it's not really academic discourse. Usually most of the comments fall into one of three categories: physical abilities. So you have to be fast, you got to be strong, you have to be able to do a lot of work over a long period of time with very little sleep and very little food, which I've been told actually sounds like a surgical residency. technical abilities, so whatever your job is, whether you're a medic or a comms guy or a demolition specialist, you need to be good at that particular technical skill, good at that job. And finally, cognitive abilities. You have to have a good head on your shoulders. You have to be able to maintain cool and be calm in very stressful situations. You have to be able to adapt, improvise, and overcome. Because situations like this, I mean, you have about a minute before you impact the ground at 130 miles an hour, so you got to be able to make decisions quickly. Situations like this, you're conducting close quarters combat operations. You're working very close with other people with loaded weapons, and you have a very very short interval between when a threat might pop up. So you have a very little, very small reactionary gap, as we call it. So you got to be able to make good decisions, make them quickly. I think these environments might seem really disparate to most people, right? There's not a lot of similarities between combat and medicine, although after witnessing the last little bit of that M&M, I might redact that statement. But I think there are a lot of similarities if you think about it. There's our important decisions that affect lives. We all make them, and they're unpredictable, nonlinear, dynamic environments that are constantly changing. There's so many variables involved, and a lot of the time the information's incomplete, right? The stories you get are vague, all the facts aren't really there, and you have to make the decision before you can actually collect and analyze all the facts. This is a time-sensitive environment. So I think there are similarities. And when we talk about decision-making, I think that the prevailing ideas of decision-making up till recently were almost strictly platonic. You know, we're human beings are strictly rational creatures. And we make all our decisions through analysis. We use all these higher level functions. But I think that's changed a little bit in contemporary understanding of how we make decisions. You go back up a little bit to the early 1980s, it was a gentleman by the name of Gary Klein. And he actually received his PhD in experimental psychology. Very interesting guy. He became a pioneer in the field of what started to be called naturalistic decision making. So instead of looking at like rats in a maze and whether they went left to get the provolone cheese or right to get the Swiss cheese or what they did, he was actually interested in how people make decisions in the real world, especially in very dangerous environments and under stress. So he went out and he looked at and analyzed fire ground commanders and police chiefs, surgeons, emergency medicine physicians, ICU nurses, paramedics, naval commanders, Marine Corps infantry team leaders. Those are the kind of people he looked at. And the interesting thing was initially he hypothesized that it was because they were smart. They were very smart people. They would very quickly look at a situation and they'd brainstorm. They'd come up with a bunch of different solutions to the problem, and they'd compare and contrast the solutions, and they would optimize. They would find the best solution to the problem, and that's what they would go with. And he found out that he was wrong. What he actually realized was that they went through this process that he started to call recognition prime decision making. So in other words, it consisted of two primary pieces, pattern matching and recognition, and two, mental simulation. So he realized that the guys would show up, so like the fire ground commander, for example, he shows up, he's pulling up in the fire engine, and he sees the fire, he sees the structure, and that immediately dredges up from his memory certain patterns of fires that he's seen, situations that he's been in. And he uses those memories as sort of a mental machinery to run a series of very quick mental simulations. Is plan A going to work? No, we don't have enough time to do that. What about plan B? No, I don't have enough manpower to do that. What about plan C? Okay, plan C will work. So he comes up with the first option he can think of to satisfy the situation. And a lot of his contemporaries did a lot of other research, gathered a lot of other data in terms of the very important role of emotion and feeling in how people make decisions, which was kind of cool because if you look at the commentary from a lot of the initial research, from a lot of the survey research, people would say things that they ask people like, how did you know what to do? I mean, it's a very complex situation. And they just say, well, I just kind of felt I knew what to do. I just had this gut instinct that it was the right thing to do. So it was interesting. And those ideas about the role of emotion in the limbic system in cognition really was the genesis of what we call intuitive decision making, right? Using your intuition to make decisions. And all decisions, for better or for worse, to one degree or another, are these sort of combinations of intuition and analysis, right? And under certain circumstances, one might work better than the other. For example, when you have very little time and your goals are ill-defined, the situation is constantly changing, intuitive decision-making turns out works really, really well if you have experience, if you possess the mental machinery to kind of run those mental simulations, right? Because you can do it very little quickly. There's very low, it's a very low energy pull on your brain to focus and analyze things, opposed to other situations where analysis actually works really well. You need it. I mean, you don't want the guy who's designing, you know, the ceramic plates on the outside of the space shuttle to be like, yeah, I think that works about right. I have a good feeling about this, man. Don't worry. Just take this thing up there. You'll be fine on reentry. Trust me. Right? You want him to sit down. You want him to run the numbers. So in situations where you have to resolve a specific conflict or optimize, find the exact right solution, the perfect, the best, analysis is really good, especially for things that are very computationally complex. So I think Daniel Kahneman, he's a Nobel laureate and author of the book Thinking Fast and Slow, puts it a little more elegantly. He divides it into two systems, really, system one and system two. And he refers to system one as sort of the fast system that's able to process things unconsciously, as if you were driving home on a road where there's not a lot of cars, right? You just kind of make the decisions. You drive on the road without thinking about it too much. You're kind of on autopilot, right? That's system one. A very low energy demand on your brain, very low metabolic load. Easier to fool, though, as it turns out, which we'll talk about later when we discuss cognitive biases and traps, things like that. But it requires experience. Again, you have to have the framework there in order to make these kind of decisions. The slow system, system two, again, when you have to be computationally precise, it works very well. It's harder to fool because you're focused entirely on solving one particular problem. But that means it requires your entire focus. And it's a very low, very high energy demand on your brain because you're focused on processing this one thing, looking at all the numbers, doing the math. So those are the two systems. Now, I think to a certain extent, without all the data and without all the science, there are certain people throughout time that have just kind of understood this. Sun Tzu, von Clausewitz, a number of scientists, physicians, people who just kind of understood how to make these kind of decisions. And one of those people was Colonel John Boyd. He was actually a fighter pilot and became a prominent military strategist in the latter half of the 20th century. And he was nicknamed 42nd Boyd because he had this standing challenge to everybody out there that in 40 seconds or less, he could move from a position of disadvantage, i.e., you know, you're on his tail, able to engage him with your weapon systems, to, in essence, turning the tables. He could be on your tail, locked onto you. Interesting thing was, he never lost, not once in his whole career. 0% failure rate, 100% success. He never, ever lost. Not in combat, not in training, never. And he had this really interesting concept of how we make decisions. He believed it proceeded in this cycle that he called the OODA loop, O-O-D-A, observe, orient, decide, and act. So first, he would say, you kind of observe everything that's going on around you consciously and subconsciously. You take in all this information, auditory cues, visual cues. You begin to process it. You synthesize. You use those analytical and intuitive tools in your brain to process things. So, for example, if he was flying against an opponent, intuitively, he knew what his aircraft could do. He knew what the controls would do. He knew what his aircraft was capable of and how his weapon systems would work. He knew that from his experience. Then he analyzed, he had to think about what his opponent's experience was, what his opponent's aircraft was like. And he would use those to formulate a decision. He would very quickly act on that. And then he would immediately begin this cycle again, observing, orienting, deciding, and acting. Now the interesting thing about Boyd, the other interesting thing I think, was that in a time when the United States military, the Air Force in particular, was almost entirely focused on technology, building faster planes and bigger bombs and smarter missiles, Boyd was the guy who stood up and said, you know, that's cool, that's really interesting, and that's great, I'll take a faster aircraft, but I think you're missing the point. The guy who wins is not the guy with the faster plane or the bigger bomb. It's the guy who can outthink his opponent. It's the guy who can make decisions and solve problems just as fast or faster than those problems are presented to him that's going to win. It's the guy who can go through this loop quicker. That's the guy who's going to win. And he called the process by which he worked on his decision-making abilities, and he trained other people to make these quick decisions, closing the loop, closing the OODA loop. And that's in essence what this lecture is really about, is how do we make better decisions. So now that I've posed the question, unfortunately, I have to try to answer my own question. So I'm going to try to give you five things I think we can do to enhance or improve the way that we make decisions. So first, take a load off your brain. Cognitive offloading. Last week, Dr. Lewis talked about cognitive load in terms of its birth when we were figuring out what the cognitive load was when we were trying to train people, right? When you're trying to teach people something, there's a finite amount of, in essence, brain RAM that each person has, and you have to figure out how to maximize that RAM in order to teach people things. And I think there's a lot of people that believe it works in reverse, too. When you're trying to make decisions, when you're trying to remember things, when you're trying to operate or fly or use a weapon system, you have a finite amount of RAM. The idea behind cognitive offloading is to use any and all tools at your disposal that are practical in order to free up as much RAM as possible. So when you have to focus on something, when you have to do something, you have a lot of that RAM free. And I think there's several things we can do to help with that. First is standardization and preparation. Really, really important. So in special operations, we call this area the golden triangle, shoulder to shoulder and down to your navel. It's the area when we're operating, we keep anything we need to shoot, move, communicate, save your own butt, that's where it is. So if we're on an assault, your extra magazines are right here, your extra ammo is right here when you can get to it. Your communication system is right here. Your tourniquet is right here, center chest. So two things, it's very easy to get to. The other thing is, if one of my extremities is injured, my right arm's injured, I can still get at it with my left hand. And it's uniform, so that if I'm working with a bunch of people, I know where everybody's tourniquet is. If someone's bleeding out, I don't have to go rummaging through their pockets or something to find their tourniquet. So it's standard that way. And that goes across a variety of operational environments. So when you're parachuting, for example, free fall parachuting, your main ripcord is here, your cutaway is here, and your reserve is here. They're all in the center chest. When you're diving, you keep your backup regulator right here too. So if you lose your primary air source, you have your secondary one right here. So when you're 60 feet underwater, you know, and you lose your primary regulator, you're not like, that can be really, really, really bad. And I think we standardize our procedures too. So we teach people how to clear malfunctions in their weapon systems, how to reload really quick. So when you're running around talking to other people and people are shooting at you, you don't have to think about that stuff. Like, oh, step one, take this magazine out, and what's step two? You just do it. You just do it. That's really, really important. I think we've generally accepted that, right? We have difficult airway carts that are mostly the same. The stat airway kits, as far as I know, are the same in the ED as they are in the ICU, as they are in other locations. That's one example, too. And I think there's also utility to teaching how to do certain emergency procedures the same way, so that you get used to doing it one way, so that when you have to operate under stress, you know how to do it at least one way really, really well. Checklists. So I'll keep this one to a minimum because I think it's been addressed ad nauseum in popular literature and in research, especially in cognitive science as well as social media. And I think anybody who works in the OR is probably more familiar with the implementation of checklists than a lot of other venues in the hospital. But I will say this, and that is the argument I hear most often about using checklists in emergency situations. Is that people are like, well, I don't have time. This is an emergency. I just got to do it. Well, I think if a pilot can use a checklist when their engine fails and they're plummeting toward Earth, if we can use a checklist in combat, at least an abbreviated checklist, before we make entry to a building to make sure we have all our stuff together, I think it's reasonable to use checklists in emergency medical procedures. Finally, pre-made decision points and triggers. Essentially, using System 1 or System 2 in advance, anticipating a situation that will change. So again, for example, if we were moving from my location to another location two blocks down in some Iraqi city, and we have to cross an intersection, as we come up to that, as we come up to our departure from cover and concealment, we may say or make a little plan, hey, as we're moving up to so-and-so's house, see that intersection right there? If we take fire and we have passed that intersection, that's like the point of no return. If we start getting shot at, we're going to maneuver, shoot back, make entry, neutralize, period. End of discussion. If we are on this side of the road, we're going to immediately bound back, take cover, and we're going to call in close air support. So that way, you're not in the middle of the road getting shot at, and you're like, what are we going to do? That's a bad, bad place to be. So anticipating the course to decline, anticipating things to go wrong, and trying to use System 2 and System 1 when you have the chance, when you have a minute, to make decisions in advance and come up with trigger points in everybody's head for when you're going to initiate that option or that maneuver. So avoid overloading yourself. Cognitive offloading. Use whatever tools you can, whatever you think are practical, to offload as much from your mental RAM, if you will, as you possibly can. 2, rally up. So using cognitive rally points, I think, is really, really helpful. Some people call them timeouts or stop points in a resuscitation. And we use them in the military in a fashion such that if we were traveling from point A to point B, we would have in-route rally points. That way, if anything went wrong between here and there, and everybody was separated, you come back to the rally point, and it's an opportunity to pause, see if anybody's been injured, make sure you have enough ammo, make sure you didn't drop any sensitive or classified equipment, and make sure we can still prosecute the mission. So this opportunity to pause, collect your thoughts, reprioritize everything, and move on. And I think that there's a spectrum, too, of these different rally points that you can use, and you can choose however you want to implement them. On the one hand, my favorite kind of rally point, I'll call it the hard rally point. So we're in the trauma bay and things are kind of going sideways, and one of them is like, I can't get the IV, and then the level one's falling apart and someone else is screaming and nothing's really going very well, and there's also the people all over the place that God knows what they're doing. And the attending just stands there and they're like, all right, stop, quiet. Anesthesia, intubate the patient, You put a central line in, you put a chest tube in, I really don't know what you're doing, so you need to leave. That's an example of a harder stop point. But there are softer ones too that you can use. So like when we have a patient and we're going through a scene, you take off and now we're in cruise flight, we've kind of leveled off at altitude. It's this opportunity to kind of check everything, right? Make sure the tube's in the same place. Okay, the patient's oxygenating well, they're ventilating well, look at the ventilator, okay. Their PIP and their plateau pressure look okay. Right? That's right, but their pressure is still kind of soft, they're still kind of hypotensive. So we've been through like a liter and a half of fluid, so start hanging the blood. Cool, so we've gone over everything, we sort of reprioritized a little bit, and we've come up with the next move. That'd be sort of a softer rally point. Either way, along the path from where you're going now to where you want to be, where you want your patient to be, I think it's reasonable and really helpful sometimes to take these moments along the way. So it's also an opportunity to kind of cool yourself down. Usually, when people say take a deep breath, it's just like an expression, you know. I mean it literally. And this is something I really wasn't a big believer in, but part of the psychological training that you go through is how to control your own physiological parameters using your mind, right? And I really didn't believe it. They actually teach you something they call tactical breathing. And I was like, that sounds kind of stupid, but it works. So essentially what it is very simple. You take a deep breath in for 4 seconds, hold it for 4 seconds, exhale for 4 seconds, hold it out for 4 seconds. And it's amazing. You can actually control your heart rate and you control your blood pressure using this technique. It's the same thing we teach to Olympic biathletes when they come in and their heart rate's, you know, like 180, 200 after they've been, you know, going Mach 3 across the course. And I have to stop and take precision shots. It's the same thing we teach to our snipers when they need to make really, really accurate shots. It's a very effective tool. In fact, you can see it. Proof of it is, you know, you'll be doing a night free fall skydiving jump. Interesting, at 13,000 feet, 12,000, 13,000 feet, you begin to lose visual acuity, and the green on your night vision goggles begins to kind of get blurry, and you're like, this is not good. So you actually use this technique, and things become clearer because now you've lowered your heart rate. Right? Very, very interesting, but I think it's a sound technique, so take a deep breath. So when things start going sideways, when you start having issues, or things start going off the rails, take a second, get to your rally point, come up with a new plan. Building decision-making power. So cognitive building. So from a physics standpoint, right, power is work times distance over time. But I like to think of decision-making power as knowledge times expertise over time. In other words, it's the product of the stuff you know and how you know to apply it, the tacit knowledge, how to actually get things done over time. And notice I said expertise here for a particular reason. It's because there's something very frustrating and disturbing me when people are like, hey, you just got to do this for a while. You just got to practice. And I don't deny that you have to do things over and over again to get really good at it. Tens of thousands of hours of practice. But I do believe that there's a quality component to that practice too. It's not just about doing it a bunch of times, it's about how you do it a bunch of times. It's also very important. So I think of deliberate and focused practice. In fact, snipers are some of the craziest people that you'll ever meet. And not because like they have some sort of baseline chemical imbalance. I think we all kind of have that to a certain extent. But because the way they practice is so meticulous and so focused. They don't just go to the range and start slinging lead down a target. They have very particular goals, very particular things they want to practice. So they'll shoot, they'll say, today we want to practice shooting from angles through windows at other targets. So they'll go, they'll find a building, and they'll practice in the same place. And they'll, after every single shot, they'll analyze and they'll think about what they did and how they went. Everything from the trigger squeeze to the way they were breathing. They'll start writing down things like what weapon system they were using, what ammunition they were using, what angle they were at, what angle the sun was at, what the temperature was, what the humidity was, what the wind was. It goes on and on and on and on and on. And they document this all. They write all this stuff down in a pseudo journal, if you will, so that as they're processing all this information, they're creating a record of it. And that allows them to go back and review all the information and how they made their decisions, why they chose to, you know, increase the windage or change the windage or the elevation in their shot, and how that affected their shot placement. Very, very important stuff. And finally, timely expert feedback. So this is important in terms of changing and essentially rewiring those pathways in your brain, right? When you make a decision, getting input or feedback from someone who's made that decision before, seeing how things go in order to change things that you may have done wrong or enforce things you may have done really well. So like Kurt said, you'll see me or some of my peers hanging around in the trauma bay sometimes after we drop the patient off, or you see us up in the ICU hanging around. Well, it's partly because, you know, I'm a super geek, and it's also partly because by getting that expert feedback, by saying, you know, how did that, you know, did we make the right decision here? Is it the right thing that we should have done? Do you think we should have done something different? You immediately change that pattern of thought. By following the patient in the ICU or seeing what goes on, from what we saw in the field, we saw in the ambulance or on the side of the highway, it's very important. So getting that feedback helps you to change those patterns of decision making. Socratic teaching. Okay, so this one's a little bit of a soapbox for me. I think that at least in our situation, in my situation with nurses and paramedics and other people, sometimes it's really looked down upon. And people get all upset and angry, and they think they're being browbeaten, or you know, that you're trying to stump the chump, or you're like insulting their intelligence and challenging their ego by asking them questions. Well, why did you do that? What do you think was wrong here? What do you think your next step would have been? What would you have done if? Now, after seeing, again, the end of M&M, clearly this group, I'm preaching to the choir here, and this group is very used to such questions, but a lot of organizations are not. And when people get upset about this, you know, I just want to tell them to suck it up. I really don't know what else to say, because it's a very helpful teaching modality, because it actually plays off that whole system two thing, which was mental simulation, right? You're actually building new or strengthening neurological synapses that already exist by challenging yourself to answer those questions. That's really, really important. And by you know, having your ego or your pride get in the way of something like that is really not a good thing, in my humble opinion. Simulation. Okay. So I get it. So we go down to the sim lab, and you have like this weird, bizarro, like plastic mannequin that like blinks at you. It's not exactly the same as a real, living, breathing patient who's an extremis. I get it. I really do. But as a group, just kind of throw it out and say simulation's worthless. High fidelity simulation is you know, of no use to us. You're kind of throwing the baby out with the bathwater. It's kind of, you're not looking to the advantages of the situation. There's a lot of things, there are a lot of advantages to running simulations. You get to see how other people practice. You get to experience situations, specific situations where you know the outcome that other people have practiced. You get to run through and in a sense, sort of real time, make decisions. And also practice using certain skill sets or certain tools. So, I mean, plastic sim man, I don't think you're going to get from a surgical perspective. You may not get a lot of cutting into his plastic belly, but there's a lot of other stuff that you can get out of it. And I think when we talk about simulation too, we neglect a lot of the time to talk about what might be the most high fidelity simulator that you have, which is your own brain, to think through these situations and essentially simulate, run through in your own head how you would do things and what you think you would do and how you think you would do it. Very, very important. So pump up your cognitive power. All it takes is a couple decades of anabolics and you can look just like this. Inoculate for stress. All right. So I'm not off my soapbox yet, because this is probably the number one thing that I like to preach for people. In any sort of acute, in any sort of environment where people are dealing with acute resuscitation or very, very sick, acutely ill or injured patients, inoculating for stress, cognitive tempering, hardening your ability to make really important decisions when it counts, when the chips are down. So this is one very effective way to induce stress. You tie someone's arms and legs together, you blindfold them, and you throw them in a 15-foot pool. It works really, really well. If you want a cheap way to stress someone out, you don't have to shoot at them. You don't have to do any, you know, crazy scenarios. You just have to throw them in a pool and take away their hair. So it turns out that the IRB and I don't seem eye to eye on this, because I thought it was a perfectly reasonable modality to test stress induction in undergraduate college students. They disagree with me. Agree to disagree. I think we do this a lot of the time, right? We check people off on things. We say, good, you can do it. But when we're testing people, when we're trying to see if they can do a task or a skill, it's usually in a nice, calm environment, with the exception of the person standing with a clipboard or watching you from behind the window. We check you out and say, oh, you're good to go. And this happens all the time. I can't say it about for you guys, but I know it happens in the paramedic world, the nursing world. It's like, oh, you can perform this skill. You're good to go. I'm in this. Have fun. Very different than, 2 o'clock in the morning on the side of the road in a dimly lit ambulance from performing these procedures, right? And we sort of deny the fact that there is a fundamental component of stress. There are physiological effects of stress that you have to be able to learn to deal with. And we deny to train people because we're like, oh, we don't have the time or money. You can do it. I saw you do it on the mannequin. You're good. Just go for it. You'll be fine. Not. So here you go. This is Grossman and Siddle, first of all. Dave Grossman was a ranger. He went on to get his PhD in psychology. And he's written a number of books, including On Killing, On Combat, Sharpening the Warrior Edge. And those titles sound a little intense, I know. But they're really more about the psychological impact of being in a combat scenario or a dangerous environment. And there's a lot in there that I think we can take, especially if you work in a stressful environment. So this is a chart. So they use essentially heart rate as a surrogate for amount of stress that you're feeling, right? And in this particular diagram, Grossman talks about his different zones. So the yellow zone, the red zone, the black zone. So the yellow zone is sort of a slightly heightened level of awareness and stimulation. So a heart rate of, a little less than 115, 120, you start to just lose fine motor skills, and you go into the zone he calls the red zone, which is essentially optimized for combat situations. You have your gross motor function is enhanced, your visual reaction time is better, your cognitive reaction time is also better, and then you hit the black zone, which by is no means is good. So you have this sort of heightened awareness and on heightened level of stimulation, this optimal level for combat situation, and then things start to deteriorate as your heart rate increases. So you begin to lose vision, auditory exclusion, people start demonstrating crazy behaviors, fleeing, freezing, submissive behavior, cowering, loss of avoiding of bowels and bladder. So that's bad. We don't want that under any situation. A couple of important things. First of all, I'd comment and say this kind of stuff needs to be adapted to our environment. Clearly, we're not in a combat situation, but I would argue that we want our fine motor skills. And so our optimal level of arousal, our red zone, might be slightly lower. Might not be at the 140, maybe like 90, 100, 120, somewhere in there would be optimal for us. But I think the other lesson we can learn from this is the gray zone. You can extend your functionality under stress by inoculating for stress, by training under stressful conditions and getting used to dealing with, getting used to being tired and having to come in and do something very stressful. That's really, really important. So you can learn to operate under those conditions when you really, really have to. So the rule of 130%. We were actually doing some training with a very elite Army unit, awesome guys, probably some of the best combat marksmanship, marksmen and shooters in the world. They're actually, it's kind of scary, actually. And we were taking a break, we were reloading magazines, and I happened to talk to one of their senior enlisted guys, and I was like, how do you guys get so good at shooting? How do you guys get so good at this? How do you guys get so good at target discrimination? And he was like, well, it's nothing cosmic. He's like, we just do the basics better than anybody else in the whole world. We practice making decisions. We practice target discrimination. And so it just comes naturally to people. Until pulling the trigger is like breathing. Until the weapon system is essentially an extension of your body. He went on and he said something else. He said, and we always train to 130%. We prepare ourselves, we hold ourselves to a standard of 130%. He said, because we know that under stressful conditions at night, under NVGs, that even our best guys experience a 20 to 30% decrease in their reaction time, in their accuracy, in their speed. And it's not just some arbitrary number like, yeah, it's about 20, 30%. No, they actually have a ridiculous amount of data, timed shooting exercises, engaging people, scoring them for accuracy to actually demonstrate this quantitatively. Interesting stuff. So they trained to 130%. And from that whole conversation, I kind of took two nuggets of information. First, you don't train and prepare yourself until you get it right. Train and you prepare until you can't get it wrong. And two, you don't magically sort of show up in, you know, the middle of a really bad situation and rise to the occasion. You know, it's not this sort of Superman-esque experience. You really just kind of fall to your level of training and preparation. So you always have to be ready. You train to 130%, so when the chips are down, you can function at 100%. Limbic learning. So I think there's a lot of data out there that actually shows that people learn better. You remember things better when some component of your limbic system is involved. When you feel, when you have an emotional reaction to a situation, you actually learn better. And I think that kind of rings true with me. I'm sure it does with you. I mean, you don't really remember all the bunches of cases and patients that you've seen that are really, you know, not too remarkable. The ones you remember are the ones that went, well, there's the catastrophic cases or things went really, really wrong, or things went really, really well and there was a remarkable outcome, right? You remember either side of the spectrum. And I would argue that by incorporating stress into certain amounts of training, by actually inoculating people for stress and having them have some sort of gut reaction, even if they screw up, will actually help them learn things better. So really push your limits, bring the stress, train people and prepare people appropriately. Final thing, number five, stay flexible. Cognitive flexibility. This is sort of the least potential, the least well-developed of my five things, I admit that. But what we're essentially talking about here is there's all sorts of cognitive traps and biases that you can get into when you're using primarily system one, right? When you're using your intuitive gut decision making, right? So you're talking about like a recency bias, sunk cost bias, flaws in thinking like post hoc ergo propter hoc, getting tunnel vision, all these things that you're subject to when you're making decisions. So how do you avoid them? Well, first of all, you have to recognize. This is the classic, the Meyer-Euler diagram, I believe. So the trick is, and I'm sure you've seen this before, right? You show people the first three lines, and really quickly you say, which one is the longest horizontal bar? And unless they're either smart enough to realize that you're trying to trick me, or they're like super nerdy enough to like pull a tape measure out of their pocket and be like, well, actually, let's see here. They usually just kind of go with the middle bar because it looks the longest, right? It's sort of an optical illusion when in fact all of the lines are the same. So it's one of those traps just by engaging system one and kind of being like, oh yeah, the middle one looks the longest. It kind of fools you a little bit. So how do you avoid that? Well, first of all, you have to acknowledge the fact that these biases and these traps exist and everybody is susceptible to them, right? They're out there. And you can ask yourself disconfirming questions, especially when you get to a rally point, for example. It's like, man, something's going on here. It just doesn't add up. Is this really what's going on here? Does this really make sense? Am I missing something? Asking yourself those questions at those rally points or their stop points in resuscitation, whatever you want to call it, can actually be pretty helpful. And review your individual practice. So if you know you have a tendency to act a certain way, to do certain things, to get tunnel vision on certain things, identifying that and being aware, self-aware of those problems that you personally tend to have and avoiding them. Engage in effective team dynamics. So actually using different members of the team to be like, yep, this is what's going on. Hey man, do you really think that I'm on the right track here? Yeah, okay. Bouncing it off other teammates. You know, whether it's another resident or an attending or a nurse or whoever, that can be really, really effective to help jar you out of whatever path you're thinking of or whatever tunnel you're looking down. So be flexible and avoid those traps. So in summary, the things that I want you to walk away here from are knowing, understanding that all the decisions are really a balance of analysis and intuition. Thinking about Boyd's loop and understand this pattern is cyclical. You're constantly going through it, and we can close that loop down. We can actually try to build and improve the way we make decisions on a regular basis using those five concepts. Take a load off. Maximize the amount of RAM you have available to you at any moment to make decisions by using whatever tools you can to help you offload that stuff. Rally up when it comes time, when things are kind of going off the rails, really take a minute, pause, collect your thoughts, take a deep breath, and then make the next move. Build power over time, incorporate all those things in your practice in whatever way is most feasible in order to be able to make better decisions, and inoculate for stress. Really think about this when you're practicing or training, and make sure there's some component in there that pushes you beyond your comfort level and brings a certain element of stress. And finally, remain flexible. Try to avoid any of those decision-making or cognitive traps. And limitations. So I have to admit there are certain limitations to this. I forget who it was. Prominent American statistician, Miller or something like that, who said, in God we trust, all others bring data. And I have none, so sorry. I don't have any, like, you know, prospective randomized controlled trials to show you that, you know, glorious five things improve outcomes, patient outcomes, and 6-day mortality. Nothing like that. I can't, sorry. Hopefully, at some point I will, but I don't at this point. The science is still evolving, so this is changing too, and like many things, I may find out in 2 years that I'm absolutely wrong about one of these things, but I'll continue to change it. The suggestions here are, you know, I originally designed this for like flight providers and paramedics in the field, but it can change to adapt it to your own program and what you do. Finally, you have to have buy-in. So I don't know, I haven't figured out yet or cracked nut how to make people want to get better. You have to want to make better decisions. You have to want to actually get better and improve yourself and hone your skills to actually engage in these five things and try and work on it. But you really need buy-in. And finally, I think the next step is looking at groups. I mentioned it slightly, you know, once or twice, but looking at decision-making in large groups or teams and how these things affect that would be interesting. I think it would be really interesting to look at. So it's easy, right? It's simple, very straightforward. Unfortunately, it's not. I think it's going to take a long time. I think it takes a lot of work, but it's worth it because I think that decision making is a really big opportunity. It's a really big area for improvement. And I think every day is an opportunity to work on that, to become stronger, to become faster, to become better at making really important decisions, because I think we owe it to ourselves and we owe it to our colleagues, and most of all, we owe it to our patients. So thank you very much. I appreciate you guys staying here. I know I ran a little bit over, but thank you.